Richmond CEO Brendan Gale has famously turned around the fortunes of the Tigers during his 10 years in charge. And here he takes us behind the scenes of that journey. He talks about Dusty, Cousins, Hardwick, the AFL job. There's a reference to a French philosopher and the Tassie license. And you be the judge on his singing talents when you hear him bang out a few lines of Paul Kelly's To Her Door. Brendan Gale, thank you for joining us here.
Pleasure, Damien. Good to be with you.
22 years of service to the Richmond Footy Club. 12 as a player, nearly 10 as a chief executive officer. It's a lot of time at the one club for a young 50-year-old. You've witnessed it.
Yeah, I mean, people like that, I've never really thought about the cumulative tenure, I guess. It's a long time. But, I came as a young boy and now I'm an adult. I think I'm an adult. It's been an incredibly formative part of my life, and some great experiences and some tough ones as well. Some great friendships and lifelong friendships. But within that time, also had 4 or 5 years at the Players Association as well. And that was actually, upon reflection, that was a really insightful time, because having spent so long at one club as a player, to experience other clubs, 2 or 3 times a year in different circumstances and dealing with different situations and disputes. You got a real look inside other clubs and how they rolled as well. So that was a great experience as well.
Yep. In terms of legacy, a word that footy people use, I think many Richmond people would feel you've already left your legacy on this club with what happened in 2017. But I also know you've got other ideals and other pursuits that you're still undertaking. What would be, in your eyes right now, as you sit here about to enter the 2019 season, your legacy, and what may it be by the time you actually do leave, whenever that time comes?
Once again, that word of itself is probably a little confronting, Damo, because legacy is almost suggestive of the fact you're on the way out. But no, look, legacy in terms of the football club, it's our vision of success is of a strong and bold premiership club, a strong organisation, strong culture, bold entity, and a club that consistently contends, we're in a nice position. We can, as we approach this year, I'd like to think we should challenge for the upper echelon, the competition, I come from a club that was very much hand to mouth. And I saw the impact that had on a range of decisions and the resources and the support that was able to provide coaches and administrators. And I just want a club that's really strong, organisationally strong, and a strong business, a really successful, super competitive footy club, and also really good people. I want to have really, I'm blessed to have really good people at our footy club, and some have left with a really, really strong culture. So it's very much a work in progress. We're not there yet. Maybe I'll never be satisfied. I don't know. But
yeah, that word itself, legacy, it was the title of a book pertaining to the goings-on of the famous All Blacks rugby union team. I believe you read it, and I think you've spoken about this a few times, about some learnings out of it. Are you able to compartmentalise now those particular learnings that have meant something to you and ultimately affected and impacted the Tigers?
I've read it many, many times, Damien, and it's a great book. I'd recommend anyone to read it, anyone, because I think it's applicable to sport, business, life. I think it's it just highlights the importance of purpose and understand why you exist. There's another saying I think was in the book. It's that profound, I've actually forgot it. People don't buy what you do, rather, they buy why you do it. So it's the underlying motivation, it's the underlying purpose of an organisation that I think is the most powerful. That's something that book really articulated, and I think, knowing why you exist, knowing what you stand for, knowing where you're trying to take an organisation, knowing the means by which you want to get, that those first principles are really, really important. They're the bedrock. And you've got to get those right. I guess.
In that context, why do you do what you do then?
Well, in terms of my role at the Richmond Football Club, our underlying purpose of why it exists, it's not about premierships. It's connecting to thrive and win. It's about connecting with our community that gives us a license to operate. It's connect and to operate a team. It's authentic connections with each other to run a team and an organisation. And we believe, you know, that's the environment where people thrive individually, personally, professionally, and ultimately win. And it's not just about winning premiership. So, so that's the purpose of the organisation. I guess my purpose as a leader is to lead that. Purposeful individuals, purposeful organisations are ones that tend to perform better than others, I reckon.
Yep. The sweep the sheds component to that book too, which was embraced by the club and so many other sporting outfits since. So simple in its premise, isn't it? And yet so crucial to help making a team, a club and working all together. Can you just take us through what that part of that book meant to you?
Yeah. Well, it was a small anecdote, but it was about the book was the experience of an organisational psychologist that was embedded in the All Blacks a year out from the World Cup to see how they teamed and see how they operate. And perhaps, I do like rugby, but what I didn't know was that All Blacks, despite their prowess and despite the fact that's the only game they play, they were great, dare I say, chokers almost on the world. They'd get to the World Cups and fall over. And so, they're going to document, the road to the World Cup, and this is one of his first, being embedded in the group. They played a, 6 months out, just a friendly down at Dunedin, and when the team finished out a rudimentary win against Wales or something, and there was Richie McCaw picking up all the rubbish, and it was a demonstration of humility, really, and also responsibility. If they can't take care of themselves, no one else will. So, but also humility that, they haven't got all the answers. Mm. It's sort of a state of perpetual curiosity, I guess.
I'm paraphrasing what you said a few moments ago about you're not existing to win premierships, but ultimately that's what you're judged on, isn't it? And you finally got one in 2017. So, when you say you're not judged on that, the public does judge you and the people beneath you on that.
Yeah,
how do you marry that up?
No, that's true. No. There's nothing more important than playing really strong competitive football, playing in finals and winning premierships. We can't do anything more important as a football club. But we actually exist for a broader set of reasons. We exist. We're a club. We're a community club. We represent members. We give them a sense of pride and satisfaction. We provide a means of inclusion where people feel valued. I mean, all these things are broader, I guess, and they provide the basis of a really strong organisation, a strong club to sustain that effort and the competitive part of the business. So that's how I reconcile it. Don't get me wrong, there is nothing more important than that. We can't do anything more important as a football club than deliver premierships to our members. Mm. But we actually exist for a broader set of reasons.
Yep. So you win one in 2017, and there's been enough said about, I think, that success without us needing to delve into it too greatly here. 2018, it was going so swimmingly until very late August, wasn't it, when just maybe around 23 games, just a few things happened, and then it just, despite winning a first final, never clicked, did it really? I would imagine you would analyse that deeply and want to know why. Why did you fall short last year now?
I think it was probably a little earlier than around 23. And, I think, upon reflection, when you're in the moment, you're optimistic and you're hopeful and you're probably seeing the positive from where I sit anyway. But upon reflection, the KPIs that underpin the way we play were coming off.
Right. Did you know that at the time?
Mindful of it. But thinking... they'll recapture that, when the moment comes. So they were coming off, and perhaps exacerbated by, we're two games clear on top. You can start to manage players a little better. Finish the season, you get a game's break. after the season. You win the first final and then another week's break. I just don't think we'd... You know, we weren't sharpening the saw, whereas the year before was just hell for leather. It was... We just had to ensure that top four spot. We got it. We faced Geelong in the first final, who have tormented us for 10 or 15 years. It had only just beaten us 2 or 3 weeks earlier. They come out and played on the edge. Then we've got the Giants at home, and you know they're an incredibly talented team, and then all of a sudden we're in a grand final. So I think we're playing on the edge. But you know, maybe you know, 2 games clear and you know, coming off, and maybe, you know, I thought our guys' approach was fantastic all year, but maybe when you're just everywhere you turn, you know, back-to-back, raging favourites on the way, maybe a bit of it sinks in. You know, we're only human beings. Mm. Talking to Justin Lepich a few weeks ago, he said in all their premierships at Brisbane, they never finished on top. It's food for thought.
Mm. How do you, as leader of the organisation, then deal with that? Knowing it was so close and for so long going so well, the premiership defence, and then you've been around long enough to know that you don't get a lot of opportunities, do you? It's a wasted opportunity in your eyes now, what happened last year?
Oh, I think there's no beating around the bush. We finished on top of the ladder. It was a great opportunity to go back-to-back and we missed it. So, on the night, it was pretty hard to watch, and so how did I approach it? I think halfway during the last quarter, I think we're gone. I just went down to the rooms just to gather my thoughts and how would approach it post game. So look, at the end of the day, you know, Damien and I addressed the group and all the staff, and just said I think it was a really well, certainly credit to Collingwood. They were outstanding, but said we've got to be accountable for that performance, and we will be. But putting all that aside, I couldn't be more proud of them for the way they responded as defending premiers, to put themselves in a position to win another one, to finish top of the ladder, get to a prelim. I couldn't ask for more. And as an administrator, we couldn't ask for more as a club. That's sport. Win, you lose.
Yeah. But the dynamic of bringing someone as profiled and as talented as Tom Lynch into your mix, as you did, and again, it's played out publicly, so I don't need you, or I'm not asking you to delve deep into it, but can I just get your take on the acquisition of him and how it played out, and the balancing up of what you already had and what you and others at the club felt you needed to get and add in to keep yourself up near the top of the ladder. If I can just ask you to snapshot the entire project to bring someone like that in.
Oh, well, he's an incredibly talented player, and I mean, we've got a responsibility to bring talent in to give our team and the list the best chance of winning. So he's a player that addressed, a shortcoming of ours. The way we play, forward pressure means we get a lot of forward 50 re-entries, and to have another tall marking forward to support Jack, I think would be huge. I think for those reasons he complements the group. I think the group are mature enough. I think our culture's strong enough to really welcome a player like Tom and to make him feel valued and important.
The dynamic of a group is so crucial to what you've done in the past few years, and obviously bringing someone like that in has potential to change it. Did you personally broach it with the bigger profile players at the club about that aspect?
No, I didn't. But it's something that is discussed internally in terms of management. And so, you know, Blair Hartley and Neil Baum, absolutely they're involving the leaders in those sorts of discussions when it's potential, I guess, when it's potential, when it's just speculative and it's is the sort of player or these sorts of players might add value. And but certainly, yeah, when the season comes to an end and it's decision making time, absolutely those sorts of players were involved.
Yeah. The impact on the overall dynamic of a playing group it can be influenced by an individual, can't it? And I refer there to you when you started as chief executive of the Tigers. You'd inherited a player on your list in Ben Cousins who was made a Tiger under a different regime. Can I get you to reflect upon his time at the Tigers, and was it the right thing to do now upon reflection?
Look, at the Players Association, I had a very different view, and I was very, very strong about his right to be redrafted, and I thought he was given the opportunity, and I was very proud of the club when they made that decision. It didn't work out, but look, the club was in desperate need of more talent. Ben's obviously a very talented player, incredible work ethic. Look, in hindsight, it didn't work out, but I'm proud of, you know, people like, you know, Craig Cameron and Damien who gave, you know, look, let's be frank. Ben entered the club at train wreck, and we played his last game for the club on a Sunday at 3:30 at Etihad Stadium against Port Adelaide in front of 40,000 people. And he got a send-off fitting of Jack Dyer. And I was really proud of the role of the club. I mean, the club couldn't have done any more to bring this guy in, to give an opportunity and to send him off into life in the best possible situation. Mm-hmm. So did it work out? No, it didn't. But, gee, I thought we gave him a really, really strong opportunity to springboard in the next phase of his life.
Yeah. You had the lens on that, as you referenced there, from the Players Association side of things, and then by inheriting or taking on the chief executive role at the Tigers, you saw it from that perspective as well. Was there a marrying up, now that you've seen it from both sides? Were the Tigers the right fit for Ben? And was there part of it, upon reflection, that he may have been better off not going to the Tigers?
I don't know that, Damien. I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for other clubs. I don't know. I think he was really appreciative of the right to play again. I caught up with Ben a couple of years ago. He's got great affection for the Tigers. And, so I probably can't answer that.
Yeah. Dustin Martin is an intriguing character for so many reasons, Brendan. And again, just the contractual side of his time at the club. It was early, or relatively early in your piece, when the GWS offer came in, and that was played out quite publicly with the tour of the facilities. When you look back on that period where the club made a statement beyond that particular meeting of his with the Giants about the contract being, you know, basically taken off the table, when you look back on that, what do you immediately think of, and could you have possibly envisaged then what has become of that relationship with Dustin as a Tiger?
I thought that situation was handled very, very well by Dan Richardson at the time. He was the head of football and obviously had great experience in player-athlete management. I think the contract had been with Dustin, who's managed for some time. Dan formed the view that we revoke it. I remember when he rang me on a Sunday morning, I was having a coffee at home, and I thought, wow, that's just thinking how that might play out. And I thought, he's a pretty good player, Dustin. You know, he's a, but I thought it was expertly handled, and the rest is history. But
was it a chess move, that statement? Or was there a genuine, at that moment, fear or possibility that he wouldn't beat the Tigers?
I think it was based on Dan's experience, it was probably a tactic just to kick things along a little bit. I mean, we're always confident. I mean, you know, Dustin loves the club. The strength of his relationships with people all throughout the club. So I guess we're confident. But look, from his very first game, he's shown some extraordinary attributes, and he's a wonderful player. And Like most young men, kids, when they come to the game, they tend to get better as they mature, and he certainly epitomises that.
Was there a time when you were worried for what may lay ahead for Dustin?
Not really. I mean, Dustin was a young boy who came from a pretty tough upbringing who. Was we're still growing and still learning in the very public sort of fishbowl life of football. So, so he had, you know, I guess I was comforted more by the fact that he had some really good people around him. Like, I think, you know, I think the story of Trent Cotchin in Dustin's development as an individual and as a player is probably it's an untold one. He's got some really strong role models. I mean, even early days living with Gary March, who was the president at the time, right. Had quite a formative influence. And he's a hard kid not to, you know, I think he was frustrating at times, but he's a hard kid not to love.
Yeah.
And he's a fierce competitor who desperately wants to win and wants to get better. And that always gave us great comfort.
Yep. The untold story to which you referenced there with Trent, obviously there's privacy and there's confidentiality attached to all of it. But can you tell us something now that we don't know about that relationship?
No, I just think Trent, you know, who was the epitome of leadership and willingness to think outside your own experience, I think, which really impressed me. And Trent was he's probably 21 going on 30 in terms of his attitude to football. He was married, he started a young family, he was a young captain with all the responsibility that goes with being captain of Richmond. But just for his willingness to really to go the extra mile and look out for Dustin and, stood out generally.
In 2019, Damien Barrett will go inside the stories in conversation with the most influential figures in football in his new weekly podcast, In the Game, exclusive to afl.com.au and the AFL app. Subscribe to In the Game with Damien Barrett wherever you get your podcasts or connect with Damien on Twitter via @BarrettDamien.
You obviously copped it at the time with the 3-0 and 75 pledge, the three being the references to finals appearances, the zero debt and the 75,000 members. And I can't remember, Brendan, if I expressed it publicly, but I wouldn't be truthful if I wasn't saying this. I did doubt it privately at least. When you did it, did you know it would be so instantly impactful?
No, it was a turnaround project. That's what it was. It was with turnaround, you've got to create a sense of urgency around the effort. And I guess, you know, we had a very highly detailed metric sort of driven strategic plan, which was highly accountable, but we just wanted to capture the essence of it, a really simple proposition. And that was, you know, three finals was just finals. It wasn't grand finals or it wasn't premierships, but that was considered a stretch back then.
It was, wasn't it?
You know, we're $5 million in debt and...
And 75,000 members was unheard of.
Yeah, so it was. You know, I always felt Richmond's a very ambitious club.
Did it sharpen you up personally too by going public with such statements?
I think you've got to put yourself on the hook.
Yeah.
And I think we all had to put ourselves on the hook.
Did you cop it? Did you worry and doubt after doing it?
Of course I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, if you don't lie awake at night, it's probably not worth doing, you know. I mean, there's that I wanted that level of discomfort. And
does anything else?
But putting aside the ridicule and the contempt and all that sort of stuff, that's secondary. But no, there's absolutely moments of self doubt. And
do you still have those moments?
Of course I do.
Do you? Are you able to tell us what it is that bounces around in the brain at that time of night?
Oh, I mean, it's just part of being a human. I mean, there's times you doubt your capacity to do things, but you've got to acknowledge that that's just rumination, and it's a matter of recognising that for what it is and compartmentalising. And I'm a very positive person, a very optimistic person, and a very resilient person. But no, I'd be a liar if I said from time to time you don't have doubts. But it's recognising them, it's processing and dealing with and moving on.
Yeah. Anyone who knows you well says you've got one of the great life and work balances and that you do balance it up. It's probably skewed most of the time, but you do find time and you know that you need to find time for yourself. And surfing, music, just getting in the car, driving, you've got a place somewhere, don't tell us where it is if you don't want to, but how often do you do it and how important is it for you?
It's not as good as what I'd like. Yeah. I found through 16, it was really, really tough. You know, it's and you know, like most of us, when things aren't working at work or whatever, you spin the wheels harder and faster, and you dig yourself into more of a hole. And I think that probably epitomised a lot of the club in 16. So, but you know, the ability to step back and to fight to find that time for yourself is really, really important. To think and to process, and it is hard because this is a consuming life. It's a 24/7 life, and then your responsibilities as a father, as a husband, as a greater, you know, and I could be better, much better. I guess we all could, but you've got to, you know, finding time for yourself to nourish and to reflect is really, really hard. You've got to fight for it.
So what do you do?
Well, probably the thing that I've really discovered in the last couple of years is cold water swimming. I mean, I've become one of those crazy sort of icebergers that swim in the bay all through the year. And I find that's 20 minutes, 30 minutes every morning, you know, most of the time in darkness. That's my time. And I just sort of have a bit of a swim and play around and you know, jump in the hot shower and you're jumping out of skin. So I find that really therapeutic and sort of re-energising. And, you know, I think when you come from a background in sport, you've got to keep that sense of physical activity up.
Yeah.
And I'll probably let that go. But and love my surfing and...
Yeah. Mm. Music's another passion?
Love my music, yeah, love my music. And, you know, I used to like get out seeing bands and stuff. I don't tend to do that too much anymore, but always, yeah, kids are musical and, yeah, so...
Indie style of preferences?
Oh, yeah, probably. I've got a very, very broad... In fact, I was just listening to UMI on the way in on Shuffle, so I've got a very broad sense of music, mate. I could listen to some beautiful classical music, sort of punk, Johnny Cash. Like, I don't know,
What was Tim Rogers singing then?
I don't know, it was Hi-Fi Way, the album. It was... he's a mad footy fan, Tim Rogers. Do you know that?
Yeah, I do. North Melbourne.
He is in North Melbourne.
Yeah. He went to the North Melbourne, what do we call it, the charity fundraiser to keep him in Melbourne when the Gold Coast move was afoot.
Well, he sat in front of me in the 2015 elimination final, it was, MCG. Just right, I know Tim, I love you, he's a great fella, but just jumping up with his hair and clothes, I wanted to choke him, I swear to God, every time North kicked a goal. And they kicked a few that day, a few late.
Paul Kelly's another favourite?
Yeah, no, I don't mind Paul Kelly. Yeah, like, I've met Paul a few times. He's a great fella, great Australian songwriter. And
did you play him as one of the cover songs when you were with Trial by Video with yourself and who was it? Paul Bullis,
one of the great
Tony Woods.
Low points of my life.
Who else was in it?
James Manson.
James Manson was in it too. There's some hair happening.
Alan Jakovich.
There's some hair happening.
Jacka was a real showman. Jacka, he's the Tom Jones sort of had the swagger, and then he disappeared. Mark Zanotti come in,
more hair.
So they were good.
You sang and played guitar. Is that
I
right?
Play guitar. I played. I had glandular fever, an entire preseason, and like pretty bad, and I was bedridden and just sick of watching videos.
VHS.
Yeah. And I'd always liked music. My mother was a piano teacher, so I just taught myself guitar and learned four or five chords, and you're away. So,
but tell me you do a good To Her Door.
Can
we get a couple of?
Well, I've sung it live. I feel very self-conscious and embarrassed, but I did sing it live in front of about 40,000 people.
40,000.
I did. I sang it at the MCG at the opening ceremony of the World Foreign Police Games. And I've just they got married early, never had much money. Then when he got laid off, they really hit the skids, and off it goes. So very flat, mate.
Keep going.
I think you've done me. I think I'm stumped.
He started his drinking, didn't he?
He started his
drinking.
I'm not standing by to watch you slowly die. So watch me walking out that door. I could keep going out that door if I sing any more.
One more on yourself before we get back into some nitty-gritty footy topics quickly. Human Rights Commission is another passion, yet another diverse passion of yours. You sat on the Australian arm of that for some time and you're pretty emotional and involved in that.
To be fair, it was the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission, and it was the time when the government, the state government, was trying to sort of mainstream the whole human rights agenda, where it's often seen to belong on fringe interests and sort of ivory towers. So they're trying to sort of mainstream the dialogue around rights and responsibilities. And it was probably more in recognition of the work that AFL had done, you know, in terms of occlusion and racial religious vilification, and a probably reflection of the AFL's traction within the community. So Rob Holles, I think, was the Attorney General, invited me onto the commission. Had 3 years, was good. Learned a lot.
Did you?
Yeah. Oh, just how it was a statutory entity and how the machinery of government works. And no, it was a good time.
Okay. Now I know you like talking about yourself, and you weren't going to do this interview unless you allowed me to ask the question about yourself and the AFL role. When do you start here?
One of the great things about one of the benefits of sport, Damien, is that
and that's a joke, by the way, for people who didn't get it.
Yeah.
You hate talking about yourself, don't you? You hate being linked to the AFL.
Well, I just think it's disrespectful, and it detracts from my current job. And I was about to say one of the great benefits of sport is it teaches you to live in the moment. And I'm fully focused on my job, and there's so much work to be done at Richmond, and I need to do that well. And what will be, but my 150% focus with the Richmond.
Yep. Contractually, how are you placed with the Tigers?
I don't have a contract.
Okay.
No.
So it's open-ended.
It's just an old-fashioned
employment
contract of an indefinite term. So that's pretty much it.
It is on public record that you made the shortlist the last time the AFL required a chief executive officer alongside Brian Cook and the man who ultimately got it in Gillon McLachlan. Brian Cook has recently and a few times over the journey said that he felt that Gillon McLachlan was going to get it anyway, that yourself and himself were maybe just as a backup, as insurance for the AFL. Did you see it that way as well at the time?
Yeah, I did. I felt Gil was entitled to have that job. He'd put a lifetime of hard work into the AFL, and I was strongly encouraged a couple of times to participate in the process. I didn't want to, for the very reason I thought Gil would have the job. But I just thought it was one of those probably times in your life where you sit back and evaluate, you know, who am I, where am I, where I want to get to. Is quite a reflective bit. So I thought it was a good experience.
Did you convince yourself after the process that you could have done it?
I recall getting a call from Mike Fitzpatrick the next day to sort of pass on the news, and I didn't bat an eyelid. It was just like, okay, now where am I? I was just, you know, so it didn't really have any impact. I was, as I said, there was just still so much work. This is probably 2014 at Richmond to be done. And I was extremely motivated by that and still am.
Yep. I know you do consider it disrespectful, and sorry to sort of ask another question about this topic, but there is interest out there. And if Gillon decides to leave at some stage of the next 1, 2, 3, even 4 years, would you think you're ready for that role, and would you want to do it? And again, that's not to say anything about him, and it's not to just be disrespectful for the role you've currently got. You clearly came second, a little third last time. And Brian's already ruled himself out next time.
Yeah, it's purely speculative, Damien. I mean, if I get back to doing what I do well, I mean, the rest takes care of itself, or it won't.
Hmm.
But it starts with doing my job well.
Yeah.
Right here, right now.
But if the planets aligned where it was there, you'd happily look at it.
Next question.
2016. You referred to it a few moments ago when we were talking about life balance. And it was a tough time, wasn't it? The end of the year particularly, when you had to make a decision as a club with the coach. Again, played out publicly, and you were so open as a club as to what was happening. And I think it was beautifully presented to the public as it unfolded, and even more so after the event. But when you put yourself back into that moment, how tough, how hard, how difficult was it for you personally, who was on the committee effectively to appoint Damien? It hadn't worked the way you wanted it to at that time, albeit some success in inverted commas along the way, and needing to make a potentially very tough call on someone who you're invested in.
It was a tough time, but upon reflection, it was the most powerful time we could ever. In fact, we wouldn't have won in 17 without it. We're on a perfect trajectory. You know, we're just getting better, you know, building our business, building the strength of our business, you know, making finals. I just felt winning more games each year. I think we felt that 16, you know, we lost 15 in North Melbourne. You know, we're 2 points outside the top four. If we get in the top four, continue that trajectory, get a double. And clearly, sport's got a funny way of
getting it.
Of getting it. So, and always a tough, and always felt what I spoke internally about, you know, the real test of us, the organisation, and the leadership will be when the headwinds come, and Richmond they come hard. So to experience 16, to go back and, you know, review everything about that year, but from a platform of strength and trust, because all the work we put on the alignment of those first principles, and to forensically examine the things we needed to do, and to come out and have a really better understanding of the things that really matter about elite performance, the things that really matter, and for Damien to be arriving at that process himself at the same time was a really powerful experience. So it was tough, but once we got through that, I remember, I don't want to sound profound, I'm not, but I remember reading a quote by the French philosopher Albert Camus. Don't ask me where I read it. Come across it.
That's a name I haven't heard.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And it was a quote that said, in the depth of winter, I learnt within myself an invincible summer. And I think that's an experience we all went through it made us tougher, it made us more focused, and it made us tighter. And I think the bonds, you know, Damien felt stronger. And then he was able to sort of go on a 17 and...
Mm. Mm. When you and other key people at the club, Brendan, reflect upon that period, knowing and clearly experiencing what happened the year after, was there one part of it, one moment, one patch of that period where you all look back on collectively and say, that was the day and the moment, the issue we got absolutely right to get us to this point? Or was it just the whole process that allowed you to, as you say, win 2017 on the back of what you went through?
No, I don't think there was one moment, but I just think it was just the really high level of trust that permeated the organisation. You know, for the president and her board to say to me, "Look, you know, ignore that, gather the evidence, let's just focus on that, let's deal with that," And instead of being a reactionary or you know, I think I've got enormous trust and strength from that. And that goes through the organisation. So I just think for Damien and for the coaching program and football department to go back and to reflect, to change, recalibrate, but not from a position of fear or insecurity or paranoia, but from a position of strength.
Which the club hadn't had the luxury of having had it for so long.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was just a mere player. I don't know. But that was, I think that, you know, that wasn't one thing. That wasn't one thing.
Was there a possibility at one stage that Damien wasn't going to be there your research?
No, not in the slightest.
That was written in, locked in from the outset.
Even the comment you made earlier about the decision, there was never any discussion about Damien's tenure at all.
It was how to become better.
It was about, you know, a football... It's a program.
Yeah.
Coaching is one element. You know, how can we work on that? How can we deal with all these other elements that contribute to high performance? And there was never any discussion about Damien's contract.
Mm. 18 teams, is that the right number for the competition?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think the Gold Coast Suns, I think there's some, you know, really strong outcomes in football generally in Queensland or the Gold Coast. I think you can attribute that to having two teams up there. I think it's probably fair to say they haven't been as competitive as they would have liked on the field. And
what are the positives then? Because I don't see them.
Yeah, well, I think there's participation. I think there's the growth of the game. There's, you know, I guess there's ratings. There's, you know... the value that provides through broadcasters.
As in the ninth game it's created.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, people are, I mean, I think the growth of the game in Sydney, particularly around the eastern suburbs, is extraordinary. I mean, that's all I'm hearing. So that's good, and, you know, the Giants have been a very, very good team, but... So I think so. I mean, they're big states. They're big media markets.
And just one quick one, because you're asked and you're regularly the go-to person on the Tasmanian football plight. Where is it in your eyes right now?
I don't know. I think the game in Tasmania, the local game, is struggling, like a lot of teams and comps and regional areas of around the country. But it's gone backwards in a couple of areas, which is a concern. It's interesting. There's three distinct regions in Tasmania. There's the south, the northeast, and northwest. And I saw a piece of research about 10, 15 years ago that said, on pro rata population, the two strongest regions in terms of producing draft talent, etc., are South Hobart, by virtue of population, and northwest. Right. The northeast was perhaps the softest in producing. Since 2000, I think the last 15 years, that has just flipped on its head. Okay. So the area around Launceston is now the most productive. You think, what's the difference? You think, well, Hawthorne. So, I mean, the more elite talent, the more the elite form of the game is showcased in Tasmania, I think the better. Now, that would have grown even more with North Melbourne going down there as well, and Hobart. So it's just what form of the elite game. Is it North Melbourne? Is it Hawthorne? Should Tasmania have a team of its own?
You're a businessman as much as you are anything, Brendan. Is it just dead money, though, to put a team down there, as is the fairy tale outcome?
Look, I don't think it's dead money. It depends on what you prioritise, Damien. If the AFL Commission says, well, we're the keeper of the purse, it's probably dead money. But if they say, no, we're the keeper of the code, and to be the keeper of the code, we have to have a national code, we need to make sure every state's represented, maybe you look at it differently. I don't know. I mean, if the industry can afford to have a team in Tasmania, it's just a matter of if they prioritise it.
Yeah.
And what they're prepared to let go, or what, you know what I'm saying?
I've taken up enough of your time. It's more than we agreed to. So I appreciate you hanging around for a bit longer, and thank you for your time today.
Pleasure, mate.